We as a council have committed to listening to, not dictating to, community. This is in direct response to the calls of communities most impacted by police violence.
Chief Best and I expressed serious concerns about cutting the 2020 budget for the Seattle Police Department by an arbitrary 50%.
The Seattle City Council and Mayor Durkin laying out some of the opposing viewpoints regarding this concept of defunding the police, a conversation that really kicks into high gear this week with the full council expected to approve a new budget-cutting package for the Seattle Police Department. Welcome once again to Seattle News, Views, and Brews, the coffee break podcast that helps you wade through the murky waters of Seattle area politics. I'm Brian Callanan. I'm also a host on Seattle Channel. The views expressed here are my own. Joining me, he's got his muck boots on. He's waiting right alongside me, Kevin Schofield from Seattle City Council Insight. Hello, Kevin.
Hey, Brian.
All right, here we go. In the coveted role of background noise sponsor, City Grind Espresso from the first floor of City Hall. They are closed, of course, during the pandemic. We thank them for their help. Thanks also to our supporters on Patreon. We have three new patrons to celebrate this week. Zach, Christy, Svetlana, thank you so much for supporting local journalism. If you want to join them, clearly all the cool kids are doing it, so please chip in a few dollars. It really does help a lot. Let's get started with Right Here, Right Now. So we begin the second full week of August with a momentous vote by the full Seattle City Council to approve some cuts to the Seattle Police Department budget. Kevin, I want to be clear off the top. If you were supportive or not supportive when it comes to defunding the police, this idea to cut the SPD's budget in half, that is not happening per se. I just want to touch on this before we dive into the details of what is being cut, an overview, if you will. The council's actions would save about $3 million out of a $400 million budget. They are planning to borrow about $17 million to put some money toward non-police solutions because larger cuts will take some time to negotiate, so not actually redirecting those dollars out of the SPD's budget for 2020. When the dust settles here, Kevin, I'm not saying these moves are insignificant, but can we really say that the city council is defunding the police? How do you look at that?
Well, you know, we have to remember that the vast majority of the city's SPD budget is headcount expenses, right?
Yep,
about 84% is direct expenses. Another 12% is indirect expenses related to people. So it's almost all of it. So if you want to cut the budget, at the end of the day, you're going to have to cut headcount, right? Which means we're going to lose sworn officers from the position. What they're doing right now is they've targeted about 100 positions to go. As you mentioned, because of negotiating with unions, all those things, they figure at the earliest it's going to be November 1st before they can really let people go. Mm-hmm. And it could be even later than that. So at this point, they're actually not counting on a whole, really much of any dollar savings this year.
Right.
But if they actually do manage to eliminate these 100 positions this year, then you annualize that over 2021.
Yeah.
And that could be as much as $10 million right there.
Yeah,
just as a starting point.
Well, let's talk about some of these positions that might be cut here. I know the navigation team is one that people have seen a lot of headlines about. Put that on the back burner for 1 second here. But this bigger issue here, when it comes to layoffs. So there are civil service rules in place that say you need to cut these officers in order of seniority. And the council has been saying we want to keep these new recruits we have that are helping diversify the department. So let's do the layoffs out of order. Now, the chief of police could do that. Could petition the Public Safety Civil Service Commission to get rid of the senior officers first. But I think there are going to be a few problems here. First and foremost, I don't think the chief is really interested in helping the council that much at all at this point. And these are cuts that could lead to litigation. And if that's not enough, you've got to negotiate with the labor unions too. I just don't think that these layoffs happening by November 1st, I don't think that's a reasonable timeline at this point, Kevin.
Yeah, it's really going to be super tough to get it done. And in the dueling press conferences between the mayor and Chief Best on one side and city council on the other side, this is something they've been trying to argue back and forth in public.
Yes.
And Council President Gonzalez makes a good point here, which is that, once again, if at some point we're going to be reducing the size of SPD, and everybody seems to be in agreement on that, eventually these are hurdles that need to be jumped.
Right. Right.
So whether it's 2020 and we start on this process now or 2021, we're going to have to do this. And the council president has suggested that the fact that the mayor and chief best are pushing back so hard on this.
Yeah.
Could you read that as really they don't ever want to lay off people?
Yeah.
Or just knowing that eventually we have to solve this.
Yeah.
Why wait? Why not start to solve this problem now?
Right, right. Well, let's dive a little bit further into what happens here with these cuts on the navigation team in particular. The council was unanimous in defunding the 14 officers on that team, but it seemed like there was a battle emerging over exactly where that money should end up going. There was this measure from the council to put the money into human services, financial administrative services for more homeless outreach. That squeaked by with a 5-4 vote here. And Kevin, we touched on this week. I think it's still an issue out there. If the navigation team isn't the group in charge of moving a camp that's in the middle of a schoolyard, for example, or a very busy sidewalk, who does that job? Do you think the city council has answered that?
And the city council in their press conference last week dodged that question for a little while. And eventually, yeah. Councilmember Herbold, who runs a public safety committee right. for the council, said, well, you know, today there are some cases where police officers are removing encampments, not the navigation team. So that will just sort of continue, which isn't yeah. really a great answer.
Yeah.
But, you know, this really comes back to the heart of, you know, one of the big issues, if not the big issue with the navigation team, which it has a dual role.
Yeah.
Is this a team that does outreach to homeless to get them, you know, access to shelter and services and get them off
right.
the street?
Right, but there's an enforcement part too. Yeah.
But it also removes encampments in yeah. places where they just really can't be. Mm-hmm. And many people have rightly pointed out that those two roles are just deeply in conflict with each other.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, the having that team be the ones who remove encampments completely undermines their credibility and, in fact, their effectiveness in building the kind of trust with homeless people that let them make credible offers of services that are accepted, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the council has basically defunded their navigation team's ability to really do either at this point, right?
Right.
They're going to take the outreach dollars and give those to, you know, really good outside organizations that do that kind of work.
Sure.
But this still leaves this question of, you know, who does encampment cleanup, right? And are they going to do mm-hmm. it in a humane way that we approve of? And now,
yeah, and who oversees
like,
that? Yep.
And who mm-hmm. oversees that? And, you know, I wrote an article several months ago just, you know, looking at kind of, you know, where should we go with the navigation team?
Yeah,
and I
right,
said,
right.
you know, look, we should split this out, right? There should be the outreach aspect of that, and we can outsource that. That's fine. But we really should still have a team, a very small team
mm-hmm.
that does removals where they have to be removed, and we regulate the heck out of it. So
yeah.
we know exactly what rules they have to follow.
Yeah.
We watch it like hawks and make sure they're really doing that
yeah.
in a way that we're not really doing today.
Yeah.
And just, you know, make that, you know, it's a necessary evil, and it's one that we, you know, use sparingly
mm-hmm.
and really regulate well to make sure that we are minimizing the harm that we do.
That is such a big job ahead. But you're right. I think that has to be the next move when it comes to that outreach part. Yeah.
Yeah. And the council is not taking that approach right now. They've basically
yeah.
the whole, you know, removal part, they're basically hand waving away at this point.
Yeah.
That is going to be a problem down the line.
At some point it will. I also wanted to point out that the council is moving to reduce the salary of the SPD's command staff, including Chief Best, for the remainder of this year. This is a big one, too, and I think it was, I don't know, Kevin, a political move is one way to put it. How did you look at that maneuver there to reduce those salaries of the SPD's top command staff?
Oh, it's a political move. Absolutely. It is, you know, it is at the very least punitive, if not mm-hmm. retaliatory.
Yeah.
There are 13 command staff that this would apply to, and the council chose them because they are not represented by a union.
Right.
All the union represented employees, their compensation is all specified mm-hmm. in their collective bargaining agreements. For these, the rules are different. It's whatever's in their employment agreement and sort of the city rules. And according to the lawyers that the city council is talking to, it's legal for them to do this kind of cut. We'll see. I mean, it's at least somebody is going to end up in court, right?
Yeah.
If they're making cuts like this that are, you know, effectively arbitrary
mm-hmm.
and,
yeah.
You know, and it may not stand up. But it's definitely an attempt to punish SPD.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the back and forth that's happening right now when it comes to the council moving ahead here this week. A not insignificant matter, overriding a mayoral veto this week on Wednesday as they're planning. If the council wants to put $17 million into community funding, as they're talking about, $3 million of that is supposed to come from this COVID-19 bill from the council that the mayor vetoed. So the council would vote to override that, then pass another ordinance allocating the money. These mayoral vetoes in Seattle are relatively rare. Mayor Durkin did indeed veto the council's soda tax spending plan last year. Remember that? Boy, that seems like an ancient piece of history there.
Yeah.
A veto the council did override this last August. But I'm looking at this. Is this the kind of legislative infighting we can expect in the months and years to come? Council, I know, is talking about more cuts for the police in next year's budget, but the mayor and the chief have really positioned themselves in a different way here. Is there any settling to this in sight? It's difficult to see that happening for me.
Yeah, well, you know, only in Seattle can we have, you know, all-out war between the center-left and the progressive left.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
I mean, really, it's, you know, there's just open hostility between the mayor and the city council now at this point. It isn't just about the SPD stuff. As you mentioned, you know, there's things like soda tax and other things that have been kind of dragging on like this for a while. And it's bad. And it's in a time when we have, you know, four simultaneous civil emergencies in
that's
the city.
Right.
This is probably not the time for the mayor and the city council to be at war with each other.
And
they are. And
yeah,
you know, they at their dueling press conferences, they are, you know, saying the right things about, I'm completely open with sitting down with
sure.
them.
Sure, I've heard that from the chief too.
Out.
Yep, you bet.
And you know, it's just not happening.
Yeah,
and
they're not
and
sitting so, down to do it.
You know, and I think I hear more and more from citizens of Seattle are just like, come on, you know, we need leadership. We're not seeing leadership. We're seeing the stupid infighting. Grow up, sit down. Again, you're the center left and the progressive left. You agree on 90% of this stuff.
Yeah.
Work out your small differences and let's move on.
Okay. So that was just a soap half step, not a full soap box there, Kevin. So that well played, sir. Well played. I did want to touch on one last piece here, though. When it comes to what the council is working on here, there are some concerns when it comes to the consent decree, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later on the podcast too, but when it comes to the consent decree, there are some concerns here from the federal judge overseeing that, Judge Robart, when it comes to this idea of defunding the police. You did a quick piece on this for Seattle City Council Insight, and I wanted to make sure we touched on that too.
Yeah, so Judge Robart, in a sort of semi-related ruling, talking about his ongoing temporary restraining order on the city council's ban on crowd control weapons,
which we're going to touch on in a second.
He sneaked in a last paragraph. In this last paragraph, he basically said, "Hey, city council, I'm watching you. You know, I've already put a temporary restraining order on one bill that you passed that violated the terms of the consent decree, right? And so I'm putting you on notice.
Yeah."
If you pass legislation, say, related to SPD budget that impacts terms and the process of the consent decree, and you don't walk through those processes that you're supposed to follow with those, I will have no hesitation in putting a stop to those two.
He kind of buried the lead on it a little bit, don't you think?
This is a big piece. It was very judgy in the sense that, you know, to me, it was sort of, you know, like, you know, when you go to the doctor and you sit there and you go through this litany of like, well, can you check out this and this and this? And then right at the end, you go, oh, by the way, can you look at this other thing? And that was really like the awkward thing that you didn't want to make the reason for your visit. But that's the thing that we're really worried about. You know, his order where he does all this stuff reads that way. He's got 2.5 pages of legalese about, you know, the legal justification for extending his temporary restraining order.
Right.
Which, you know, everybody was in agreement anyway. He didn't need to write any of that. And then last paragraph is, oh, by the way, and fires a shot across the bow of the city council.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about what's happening with the consent decree, a few other judicial issues as well on Now Hear This. All right, so this is the part of the show where we grab an interesting soundbite from the past week, pick it apart a little bit. I'm going to play you a brief clip from Seattle Police Chief Carmen Best, who, with the mayor, as we've been talking about, has been pushing back against the city council's plan to cut funding. She brought up this important point last week, though, about how the SPD has been working hard to comply with the federal consent decree process to reform policing, basically. This has been in place since 2012. The council may be detracting from that effort, in the chief's view. Here's what she said.
The Seattle Police Department met every one of its requirements under the consent decree and continues to work through every issue identified. Remaining in compliance is now a matter of a city issue. and reducing training, analytics, transparency, and especially staffing is not how the city will meet the court's expectations.
All right, so Kevin, just continuing down this path, the whole idea of the police department, the policies surrounding it, needing to be in line with the consent decree. We touched on this last week, too. But I want to update people on what's happening with this tear gas, pepper spray, crowd control tools, weapons used by the SPD. The council banned those back in June. Then, of course, as we mentioned, the DOJ asked for this temporary restraining order, blocking that ordinance from the council. Judge Robart is granting that, now has extended that restraining order as both sides gather more information. I really think we're on the brink of some big developments here. We're expecting reports next week from the Office of Professional Accountability, the Inspector General from the city, also the Community Police Commission regarding the council's ordinance. What do you think we're going to hear from those reports? Those are very, very important to this discussion.
Yeah, well, so the mayor and the city council asked those three accountability groups back at the beginning of June, right after the, you know, May 30th, you know, first big protest where there was a lot of rioting downtown.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of crowd control, you know, weapons used by, mm-hmm. by SPD to go off and come back with some recommendations on what the city's policy should be for use of crowd control weapons. And Judge Robart has said that he wants to hear that too, right? So it's taken them longer than they originally wanted to get their report done, but they're now, you know, expected to deliver it on August 15th at the latest.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the judge has actually pushed out the restraining order and the whole schedule for, you know, briefs and hearings beyond
that,
so that everybody can get their report, everybody can look at it, the city can respond to it, the DOJ can respond to it,
mm-hmm.
and the DOJ can decide, okay, is the city council's ban on crowd control weapons in alignment with this?
Mm-hmm.
Is it different than this?
Yeah.
You know, and have some recommendation and some suggestions on how to go forward. So,
right.
you know, by mid-September, we should, you know, be seeing, you know, everybody's cards as to how they want to go forward on this. But
right.
really the first big step is this August 15th report where we get our, you know, our resident subject matter experts on crowd control weapons to really give us some data and some information.
Meat. Yeah, because it's been such a political battle so far. We need some info here.
That's right. That's exactly where we're going with it. So hopefully that will work out to the best.
Yeah. Any expectations in terms of what we're going to see there? I think it's a lot to consider here. I know the CPC talked about it a lot, making sure that they were part of the conversation here. Any expectations about what we're going to see in those reports?
Well, you know, it's the crowd control weapons, what they call less lethal devices,
mm-hmm.
is really sort of in an interesting, awkward spot because, mm-hmm. you know, they were actually introduced as an official policy.
Right.
So as a way for SPD to have an option below using lethal force,
mm-hmm,
using guns.
Right.
So they were, in fact, mandated in certain situations that mm-hmm. they had to use these instead of using lethal force.
Right.
That's why it's put in place.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But if you look at it from the bottom up and say, are they moving too quickly from, you know, other, you know, de-escalation efforts up to these?
Yeah.
Right. Then, you know, it really, your approach to this whole set of less lethal weapons really depends on whether you're looking from, you know, de-escalating from lethal force or escalating from, you know, even, you know, less lethal, less impactful tactics.
Right.
And I think threading that needle is going to be a key part of what we see in this report.
That's a great observation in terms of where you look from. Yeah.
The city council was looking from the bottom up in this and said, we're going to ban these because we don't want people using these things.
Yep.
Right. And Chief Best came back and said, well, basically, if you do that, all we have left is guns and riot batons.
Right. But why are you using...
This was supposed to be here as a de-escalation, you know, as a middle ground between SPD shooting people and SPD walking away. Right.
Yeah.
And you just took away the middle ground.
Yeah.
And that is really the key part of what these accountability organizations, our resident experts, have to grapple with. It's like, what should be in that middle ground?
Yeah.
What tools do we have to give police officers
right.
so they have an option in the middle ground, and it's not just the shoot people or walk away options.
Ooh, man, a discussion that has been going on for decades, I know. Yep. I wanted to touch on another legal issue here, just to update people. Black Lives Matter, the ACLU, sued the city earlier this summer regarding this use of less than lethal force, tear gas, pepper spray, etc. So this is a matter where both sides are coming together on how to talk to witnesses. Looks like a few more of them are going to be coming in virtually here and also reviewing evidence. The issue with the evidence, though, close to 1,400 videos from police body cam footage. The SPD saying now it wants to release the relevant footage here, but I know the plaintiffs have a few concerns about that, Kevin.
Right. So the plaintiffs don't necessarily trust SPD's opinion on what's relevant and what's mm-hmm. not relevant. But the flip side of this is that as the defendant, the city and SPD have a right to know sort of what they're being charged with so they can prepare a defense for it, right? And
yeah.
They really don't want the plaintiffs taking 1,400, you know, police body-worn camera videos and going on a fishing day, a fishing expedition where every day there's like, hey, here's three more videos and three more videos.
And we're charging you with this, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. There has to be a bounding. There has to be a day where the plaintiffs are required to, you know, say, okay, this is everything.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So there's this battle over how much access to videos they get where they can keep coming up with new stuff.
Right. Right. Wow. That's an interesting one. But there's another very interesting piece that I thought here, a new lawsuit filed last week. Five protesters suing the city, saying this cost of purchasing protective clothing, helmets, goggles, etc., which they need to protest the Seattle police is prohibitive. That, they say, is infringing on their rights in terms of how they peacefully protest, etc. They're even calling this the protest tax, Kevin. We're recording this podcast, as I know the judge is considering this case. Do you see any merit to it? I thought this was a very interesting angle on this.
Yeah, and there's a couple pieces in it. So a lot of their lawsuit is duplicative of what the Black Lives Matter ACLU folks already filed. And, you know, the law says pretty clearly you can't keep relitigating the same case with, you know, the three new plaintiffs of the day, right? That, you know, the defendants have the right to not be constantly pulled into court. So the overlapping stuff will probably go away. But there's this one issue that you talked about there, which is the plaintiff saying, you know, because of all these less lethal weapons and tear gas and other things that the police are using, protesters feel like they need to be buying a bunch of protective gear to go out and do this, right?
Yes.
And that creates, they argue, a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution.
Like a poll tax almost,
They liken it to a poll tax where only people who can afford to buy protective gear can go protest and feel safe doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's not a great argument. And the poll, and the poll tax, you know, analogy doesn't really stand up because the poll tax was a thing where the government said, you may not vote until you pay this tax.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's not going on here, right?
Seattle police saying you may not protest. True.
And there are lots and lots of people who protest without any of this gear. In fact, the plaintiffs have protested in many cases without all this gear.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's not a super strong case, but you know, this is the law and this is the court system.
Yeah.
And Judge Jones, who's a super smart, very well, you know, trained, well-informed judge, may see something in this.
Yeah. So much going on with our judicial system right now with all these different cases. Thank you for that insight there, Kevin. I want to move on to what's next. Okay, so that loud screaming sound you heard after the governor announced last week that it's not safe for most students in our state to return to school this fall came from parents, including me, saying, oh, gosh, darn it. I really wish that didn't happen here. Kevin, I was so hopeful about this. I know a lot of parents were, but I think a lot of us expected this to happen, too. And Washington State, as we know, had some good success early on in reducing COVID cases. But this fall, an interesting point here. This is a recommendation from the governor, and just a recommendation, folks. As it stands right now, school districts will be making the call on this. So some counties with lower risk of COVID transmission may be able to have some more in-person classes. It really does feel like we're back at this point where we started when it comes to COVID impacting how equitable or not equitable our K-12 system really is. Kevin, your thoughts about this?
Yeah, the equitable and the funding situation and the access to low-income students is really a big issue. You know, what's going on at this point now is there are as of last week, 25 counties in the state that are at high risk of COVID, you know, COVID spread. And
yes,
the recommendation from the state is the high-risk ones should not bring students back. Like you said, it's not a mandate. They're not saying they may not. They're saying that they should not. And
bring it was a mandate. Now it's not. Yep.
Yeah. And King, Pierce, and Snohomish County are in that set. The metric that they're using is 75 active cases per 100,000 population in the county. Mm. And King is about mid-90s. Okay. Snohomish a little higher than that. Pierce a little lower than that.
Yeah.
But you look at some of the other counties in eastern Washington, and they're in the hundreds.
Yeah, right? Yakima hit really hard. 100,000.
Yep. Yakima's hit hard, and it's going to be tough for a lot of them.
Yeah. I know also Governor Inslee is working on this plan to send about $9 million in federal stimulus money to the Office of the Superintendent to try to help pay for some more internet access. So we'll see what shakes out there. Finally, one last piece here, Kevin, on the West Seattle Bridge. The council is considering shifting $70 million in city money for emergency work on the high-rise bridge through next spring. And this is not a replacement, folks. This is to shore up what's there right now. Basically, beyond that, that loan, that interfund loan there, SDOT would be working on selling some bonds. These 2021 bridge bonds we're talking about would be repaid through future real estate taxes. But what kind of real estate market are we really going to have when we come out of COVID next year? Is there any way to talk about that or even predict that?
Yeah, and real estate excise tax is a revenue source for the city. Basically, it's like a sales tax on every real estate transaction that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a certain minimum amount that's pretty stable for the city, which is good. And they use it for, and the state law limits what they can use it for. So they can use it for, you know, infrastructure projects like bridges. So, you know, West Seattle Bridge absolutely is in the category of things that they can use it for.
Mm-hmm.
But it's highly, highly variable, right?
Yeah.
And it turns out something like, you know, one skyscraper in downtown Seattle changing hands can be a big windfall for the city.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are years where, just in the last 5 years, where they were, you know, under for the year as to what they had predicted they were going to get. And then suddenly in December, there was one big tower sale downtown and boom, they're great.
Yeah.
So selling bonds based on this is an interesting thing because they're really making a commitment to some of that sort of minimum base every year. And there's only so much of that they can do because they can't really commit it, you know, above the, you know, looking back statistically, it's sort of what's a minimum amount of
Year? Right.
You can't get into the flexible part of this, right?
Yes,
because
right.
They have to be able to pay this every year, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are limits to how much bonding they can do based on REIT. And, you know, it's not clear that it really, what happens with REIT really aligns with the economic cycle, right?
Yeah.
Because even in down cycles, there are fire sales on real estate all the time.
And, that can yield some dollars too, right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's really, it's almost impossible to predict what is going to happen with REIT revenues for the city.
Well, I'll tell you what I can predict. Kevin's mouth watering when I show him this awesome baked treat that we're going to wrap up our podcast with. We always try to wrap up things on the podcast with some baked goodness for your coffee break here. We've sampled a lot of small bakeries around Seattle, women, black-owned bakeries, baking at home too. One of those women-owned businesses is the Birdhouse here in West Seattle. My thanks once again to Amber for providing the treat today. Kevin, take a peek at this thing here. This is Wilma's zucchini chocolate chip bread from an old friend's recipe, she tells me. What is it about this combination of zucchini and chocolate chip? It just seems to be an interesting vehicle to me, but somehow it works, that combination of zucchini and chocolate chip. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, they're really, you could think of them as different dimensions of flavor, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a single dimension, it's like, are we making this, when I added this ingredient, do I make it more sweet or less sweet? And, you know, are more sour or less sour.
Mm.
In a case like this, where we've got, you know, sweet and sour and savory and
all
salty,
working together. Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can add an ingredient and give a whole, you know, new dimension to a flavor, then it makes it really interesting. And that's why, you know, in a lot of ways, zucchini and chocolate chips or walnuts and chocolate chips work really well together. They work in different dimensions of how we think about flavor.
Indeed. All right. The third dimension chatter here with Kevin, once again, getting us through it. Thank you, as always, for your input on pastry items, local politics, baked to perfection, as always. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks, Brian.
Next time you want to know what's going on in local politics, give us a listen here on Seattle News Views and Brews. Find out what's brewing. Reach us via email at seattlenewsviewsandbrews@gmail.com. Subscribe on iTunes or Spotify. please support us on Patreon if you like. Throw us a question, too. We'll answer it on the show. And if you like what you're hearing, we certainly appreciate it. Thanks, as always, for listening. Seattle News, Views, and Brews is an independent production of Callinan Media Services. Copyright 2020.